me, won't be a big surprise if Xander Schauffele win this claret jug.
Well, who knew that the modern-day Nostradamus of golf is none other than my co-host Bob Bupka, who was spot on last week in picking our special guest that day, Xander Schauffele, to win the Open at Royal Troon. I'm Kelly Elbin, the guy who picked Colin Morikawa, and while I clearly don't have the extraordinary vision of Mr. Bob Bupka, I am pleased to welcome you to a special roundtable recap of the 152nd Open here on Musings on Golf, and we're delighted to be joined by one of the great golf writers in the world, Lauren Rubenstein, who from 1980 to 2013 was the golf columnist for the Globe and Mail in Toronto, and who has authored 16 books, including the just-published 25th anniversary edition of A Season in Dornoch, Golf and Life in the Scottish Highlands from Back Nine Press. Okay, Lauren, great to have you, but please, please tell me you didn't also predict Xander Schauffele to win.
I didn't. I didn't come close to picking the winner. In fact, I made two picks, really. I picked, guess what, a guy named Rory. I really thought he would come along and win. Maybe that was more hoping than anything. And I also threw in there our Canadian Mackenzie Hughes, who I know loves Lynx golf. And he played well, tied for 16th, and he finished. And he said, you know, I really think of the four majors, this is one that I could win. So that was a pretty good pick. But Rory, I'd have to hand in my media credentials, maybe.
Hey, Lauren, such an honor and a pleasure to be on with you. You've been a longtime friend, somebody that when I first started, you were regarded as the king, and you still hold that lofty perch. Can I get your personal opinion of what you think's going on with Rory McIlroy?
Well, I think he's had so much going on in his life, really, you know, off and on the course. I mean, with what happened at Pinehurst, obviously, he's pretty much the favorite or close to it in the top three or four every time he comes into a major. And he's acknowledged that he wants to win this a major after so many years not winning one so badly that maybe it's not too good. And, you know, it was kind of sad to see him lose out at the U.S. Open at Pinehurst, missed that putt on the last hole and the one on 16, and then wandering around New York City trying to gather himself. You know, I think he's such a likable guy, and I think he really is one of those guys who feels there's a lot more to life than golf, but at the same time, when he goes to play golf, he's putting a lot of heat on himself. And I honestly don't know how you get rid of that, really, because you can't just say to yourself, want it less. So, you know, he's obviously going through some personal things in his life, but I really hope he'll come and have a good year next year. I'd love to see him win another major or two or three. He's capable of it with that beautiful golf swing, but it's just not happening.
Yeah, I echo your sentiments. I think, you know, he's as good as they get out there, and it's very confusing to see what's happening to him. But I agree with you, and I'm glad to hear you say that. That puts a lot more weight on it than me saying it. You know, next year, he wins one, you know, he's going to be off to the races. I mean, he's so talented and hits it so far and so straight when he wants. But as we saw at the U.S. Open, really comes down to making putts when you have to make them. And, you know, that's the beauty of golf. You know you have to make this putt. And you made it 1,000 times, but it doesn't mean that you're going to make it at the right time.
Exactly. That's golf, totally.
Well, to our listeners, folks, we're going to have just a little different format this week, similar to what we've done after each of the four major championships this year. I'll sort of serve as the MC or moderator, if you will, and throw out some questions to both Lauren and Bob. And Bob, I'm going to start with you. I know your plate was really full. Had a steady stream of reports on the Open for the 24th consecutive year, by the way, on TalkSport in the UK. So your guy, Xander Schauffele, man, I really enjoyed hearing from him and interviewing him last week when we had him on. Bob, he talked about the validation that for him came from winning his first major championship. Now he becomes the first to win two majors in the same year since Brooks Koepka did so in 2018. So, Robert, my question, I guess maybe it's a comment. It really does appear that that win at Valhalla gave Xander the validation, the confidence, the belief that he could, and certainly in terms of what was going on at Troon, you know, literally weather any storm down the stretch and win a major championship.
You know, the one thing I've learned over the years, and I think Lauren would agree with it, you know, you win your first major, it is a huge deal. And then everybody thinks, oh, wow, he won one major, he's going to go on to win plenty more. But that's not the case. I mean, each victory has to stand alone, and each victory, I think it's harder to win your second one than it is to win your first one, because after winning your first one, you know you can win, but that doesn't mean that it's going to happen. But I have to congratulate everybody, the RNA at Royal Troon. I mean, you hear so much about it coming in, and then it lives up to every bit of publicity. You know, that par 3 at 123 yards, a par 5, longest in golf. I mean, it displayed itself beautifully. I don't think they could have gotten anything more at a Royal Troon than what they did with that Xander Schauffele victory.
Yeah, I would agree with you. You know, Lauren, you've covered 15 Opens. Interested in your thoughts, not only on Xander's victory, but really being able to, you know, for him, and it wasn't alone, certainly, what went on Saturday afternoon with a lot of players. You talk about a battle for survival with not one, not two, but several guys saying it was the most challenging nine holes they'd ever played on that back nine on Saturday. So your thoughts about Xander and on just the brutal conditions on Saturday.
Saturday was kind of like those of us around for a while, play a lot of golf overseas in Scotland and England. You want to see these best players in the world challenging the ground, moving around the bunkers, play strategic golf. And Xander, I mean, the PGA had to help him quite a bit knowing he can do it. But then the shots he was hitting, the power he was showing, he's in distance, really. And he never throttled back. Tremendous to see. I mean, on Sunday, everybody was bunched up. He was even down, I think, full of shots after nine holes. So he just came on strong at the end there. He shot 31 on the back nine Sunday, and he got through on Saturday nicely when he shot 69, when a lot of golfers were going for, you know, 78, 80, 81, 82. So that was quite an accomplishment. He kept himself in it, and then he put the throttle on Sunday, and he won. I thought it was a wonderful championship from start to finish.
Yeah, yeah. Let's follow up, Lauren, on that on Saturday, because I'm interested in your perspective, having covered Opens there, having, as you said, played golf over there. Physically, that challenge of what they were dealing with on Saturday is one thing, but it's also a mental grind, isn't it? Of just trying to, you know, keep your focus while Mother Nature is just kind of literally swirling all around you. It seems to me one of the harder tasks in golf, even for the elite player. You know, Lauren, you've covered 15 Opens. I'm interested in your thoughts, not only on Xander's victory, but also what Xander and a number of the guys said were really for them on Saturday the most challenging nine holes that they've ever played in competitive golf, the back nine at Troon, in terms of and I know you've played a lot of golf over there, not only the physical challenge but the mental challenge of dealing with Mother Nature and those kind of elements, Lauren.
Yes, I think Saturday is what we all want to see in an Open. Granted, it was extreme conditions, but these are the best players in the world. They're extremely good, extremely talented. And Saturday epitomized the idea that golf at the highest levels particularly is a mental game. I mean, these guys have tremendous abilities physically, and you know, the golf ball comes out of the center of the face just about every time. They control their distances well. They know what they're doing with the mechanics of the swing most of the time. So it devolves into a mental test in a major championship, especially on the weekends and the back nine. And when you get conditions like that on a Saturday, you've got to be handling it. You've got to be able to be, you know, it's a cliche to be patient, but Xander, you know, said in his post-tournament press conference that he practices patience. He's driving, and we all get into rough situations when we're driving, and you can get a little uptight. You know, you might get mad at the driver who cut you off. And he's learned to use the opportunity to control his, you know, what he called road rage, and just be patient. He talked about being in a grocery store and things aren't going the well he wants. Maybe he gets in a long line or something. Who knows? He practices patience. And I think that's a smart move. He's using experiences off the course to help him on the course in these often treacherous conditions. And it really showed up there on the weekend. The way he played and shooting 31 on the back nine on Sunday, I think will go down as one of the top back nines we've ever seen on a Sunday by a champion. So it was very impressive to see. And, you know, we can't predict, as Bob said, what'll happen from here. But that had to be a tremendous leap forward for him to handle those conditions on Saturday and go out and do what he did on Sunday.
You know, Lauren, the one thought that kept coming to mind when I was watching that, it seemed like the rest of the field was playing checkers and Xander was playing chess. He was very calculated on where his shot was going to end up. Not necessarily how he hit that shot, but what it was going to leave him. And when you have that ability, you rise above the rest of the field rapidly. And his mental sharpness Sunday was just remarkable. I mean, he was impeccable. And you know, he's really been a great talent for a while. He hadn't won a major, but now he's got two out of the last two. So we better keep an eye on him. I think they're going to a lot more majors in the future.
You're right. I mean, he's a wonderful shot maker, just to speak for a moment physically about his physical game. And when you think about one hole that comes to mind on Sunday, the 12th hole, where he drove it in the left fescue, he had, I think, 204 yards to the hole. And he hit a 7-iron out there. He hit it as hard as he could, planning for it to land short, run on the green. And he got it out of there, a clean hit, landed short, and ran up right at the hole about 30 feet short, two-putted for his par. And that just shows you his ability just to stay with the shot. He didn't let it bother him that he was in the fescue. He knew the shot to hit. He knew you could use the ground. And he did it. Again, that patience factor. He didn't try to do anything crazy, really. He didn't try to fly it on the green. And he showed that kind of discipline throughout the weekend particularly. I personally was very, very impressed. I love watching that type of golf for one thing. And he really came through really showing everything he has.
So here's what now two-time major champion Xander Schauffele had to say after winning the Open at Royal Troon.
It was hard. It was very difficult. I mean, it's a dream come true to win two majors in 1 year. It took me forever just to win one, and to have two now is something else. There's calmness and super stressful moments when you're trying to win a major championship. And, you know, I felt them in the past, the ones I didn't win, and I let them get to me. And today I felt like I did a pretty good job of weathering a storm when I needed to. It's a completely different style of golf. There's so much risk reward when the wind's blowing and 20 miles an hour and it starts raining, and there's so many different variables that come into play. And today I felt like I really controlled a lot of it. I kind of grabbed onto it, and there was no chance that I was going to let go of it. It truly is an honor to win this. It is an incredible feeling to be up here with the Claret Jug.
And Bob, Lauren mentioned that his thoughts about that closing 31 by Xander. By the way, it's pure coincidence, really. Xander shot 65 to win the PGA Championship in his final round, shot 65 Sunday at Troon. But two very, very different golf courses, very different circumstances. Bob, kind of like what Lauren was saying, I'm struggling to really recall of closing nine of that caliber to win a major championship in such conditions as what he that 31 that he threw out on Sunday.
You know, it's amazing, Kelly. His 6-under par on Sunday was the lowest round shot by anybody, and that's a very rare occasion where somebody that's in contention and has a real legitimate shot at winning shoots the lowest score. But Xander absolutely showed the rest of the field why he deserved to win. And it was a very, very impressive victory from start to finish. And I go back to that interview that we had with Xander. There was something special that came across from him. I can't really put my finger on it. It was the confidence in his tone, the confidence in his game plan. And one little reference that he let out that really was incredible. He said he has the best caddy out there. He certainly proved to be that. All his club selections were spot on. And Xander has a great relationship with his caddy. And I think that came into play quite a bit that fateful Sunday.
So, guys, let's talk about that for a minute. And Lauren, I'll go to you first. Austin Kizer and Xander played, I believe they played collegiate golf at San Diego State. Austin's been on Xander's bag since Xander turned professional in 2015. And he was just basically a mini tour guy starting out, and look what he's become. But that, Lauren, that relationship, right, that bond can be so strong and so incredibly valuable for a great player, can it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Especially when they've got a long time together, when they know each other. You're seeing two people who are working together hand in hand, and they can kid around too. I mean, I think there was a time during the championship that Austin said something to Xander, like, just hit it between those bunkers, the pot bunkers. Well, obviously the number one goal in at Troon on any open course is to not get in those pot bunkers because they're truly penalizing. And Xander had a laugh and said, yeah, that's all I need to do, hit between those bunkers. You know, it wasn't anything that he didn't think of himself, but just the fact that they can have that byplay in the most dramatic situations, I think, is terrific. And then the fact that they've been together now for almost 10 years helps. When you think about the great players over the years, I mean, I'm thinking of Nick Price when he came, nearly 30 years ago and won those three majors. And he was with Jeff Squeaky Medlin, who was a great caddy for him. You think about Jack Nicklaus way back when, and Angie Argee, I think is how you pronounce his last name. Arnold Palmer and Creamy Caroline. So it's terrific, really. I mean, those relationships are fun to watch, and I wish more. I wish there were some sort of Gene Sarazen as well with his caddy. So, yeah, it really shows up at these major championships, the teamwork, you might say. They really are a team.
Bob, you've spoken several times about Squeaky and the role that he played, obviously, with Nick, and then, of course, being on John Daly's bag at the 91 PGA Championship and the history that started there with Daly.
Yeah, that's actually a great example of what a good caddy Squeaky was. And he was even a better guy. He was a good friend of mine, and we lost him way too young. But, he's on the bag for John Daly because Nick Price can't play, and he wins the PGA Championship. And lo and behold, the following year, he's on the bag for Nick Price, and Nick Price wins the PGA Championship. He's the only caddy in history that went back-to-back winners of the PGA Championship carrying two different bags.
So pleased to be joined on this special roundtable recap of the Open Championship with by Lauren Rubenstein, terrific golf writer for many years out of Toronto, author of 16 books. Lauren, it's a lot of books to write. Did you always want to be a golf writer, an author? How did that work out to begin with?
Well, I remember in grade 11 in my English class in high school, the teacher asked all of us, do you have any idea? You're 16 years old in grade 11. What would you like to do when you're a little bit older? And I said, I want to be a writer. I didn't say I want to be a golf writer, but I said I want to be a writer. But I loved reading. I loved golf. I was, a reasonable player, played some competitive amateur golf. And I just fell into it, caddied on the PGA Tour. One thing led to another, and it became a career. Didn't even finish. I was doing a doctorate in psychology. Never finished that because I started having some success writing. And it was just a fantastic sport to write about. There were so many publications. Somebody once said that golf translates oddly well into words. And I was very fortunate to come up at a time when there were a lot of publications around. Our national paper, The Globe and Mail, took me on. Our national magazine, Score Golf, I was their first editor. Still write for them. So it was really, in a sense, unplanned. In another sense, it was really from the depths of my being that I wanted to, that I was comfortable sitting there and trying to write. And I still enjoy that part of it.
The general public is the beneficiary of your talent, Lauren. And boy, like I said, from day one that I met you, there was something special about you. You seemed to have a little better pulse for what was going on with the players, with the caddies, with the officials, with a lot of different people. And, boy, when you have a radar screen that was as sharp as yours, it's no wonder that you wrote so many books.
Thank you. I've been very fortunate to write books with some great players, some on my own, and it's really been a great career. It's kind of winding down now, but it's been a wonderful career, and I'm very grateful for really what I was able to do.
So, Lauren, great storytelling is what we pride ourselves here on Musings on Golf, and great storytelling is what you've done in the written word for a long, long time, as you mentioned. We had three fascinating stories at the Open Championship of guys who did not win, but boy, they played so hard. You had Justin Rose, major champion, trying to become the first Englishman to win the Open since Faldo in 92. You had Billy Horschel, multiple winner on the PGA Tour, who actually led going into the final round. And then you had this basically a virtual unknown in Tristan Lawrence from South Africa, who actually led the Open with nine holes to play on Sunday at Royal Troon. Lauren, three very distinct, compelling stories that I would imagine are great ones to write about just on their own.
Oh, you're right. You know, you could write entire chapters on each of them. I mean, Justin Rose, I've been a big, I've enjoyed watching him over the many, many years. I remember years ago, I was doing an article for a major magazine in the U.S., and I went up and spent the day with Justin and his wife at their home in Lake Nona at the time. And we spent basically the whole afternoon together, and he loved talking about the golf swing. I was at that Open in 1998 when he holed out on the last hole for a three. He was 17 years old and heard the loudest roar I've still ever heard on a golf course in a championship. Then he goes out and misses what, some 20, 25 cuts in a row when he turned pro, and to see what he's done to win that U.S. Open in 2013. And as he said, he left that all out there on Sunday at the Open. He played a solid round of golf, missed a couple of greens, still shot, you know, what did he shoot? 67, I think, on the last day, which, you know, had Xander not shot 65, would have been, you know, probably a winning score. So very impressive. And I would have liked to see him win for sure. I had picked him in a couple of other majors over the last couple of years, hadn't come through. And, this time came very, very close, 43 years old, but hadn't had a great year, but must have gotten a lot of confidence from this Open. And he's a really a good example of what a touring pro should be all about. Responsive to the fans, responsible to the game, and just knows how to kind of command his own mind out there on a golf course.
Your thoughts on Horschel and on Tristan?
Yeah, well, Tristan first, as you say, he was leading with nine holes to go. I was aware of him because I follow European golf pretty closely and world golf pretty closely. I've always enjoyed that aspect of the game. Maybe that's got something to do with coming from Canada. I don't know, but I've always enjoyed the international aspect of golf. And so I was aware of him. I knew that he had won four times on the DP World Tour, and I thought he acquitted himself beautifully. He played quickly. He didn't get, you know, I think he did say after his turn, after the tournament, that he tried to see it as just another tournament, which is pretty hard to do. I think maybe next time, if he's in that position again, and I think he will be, he'll realize, hey, this is a major championship and your emotions are going to change a little bit. And he might just be, I don't know, whatever it might take to get him over the hump could happen. I think he's got the ability, and those who follow the game around the world. Yes, he was very unknown, virtual unknown here in North America, but around the world, they knew that he could play. And as for Billy Horschel, now this is going to sound like a little bit of amateur psychoanalyzing, and I have no idea if I'm right or not. But I, early in the round, I texted a friend of mine. I said, watch Billy Horschel. His routine seems to be varying. In other words, he would take one practice swing sometimes. He would take two practice swings another time. He's a hyped up, he's a hyper kind of guy. He's excitable. He's fun to watch, a wonderful player. Come back from the depths from last year when he shot, what, 82 at Muirfield, I think, in the Memorial. And I just felt he was a little bit off with his timing and his rhythm. And, you know, he fell fairly far behind. He birdied the last three holes to his credit, never packed it in. But I felt like there was something off about him just from the beginning. And that's just the way it goes in golf. What can you do? It's golf.
And we're having a great discussion on golf, and we'll continue with more on Musings on Golf on this roundtable recap from the Open right after these words from our corporate partners. Our friends at William & Harry are always looking for ways to stand out in the crowd. So for anyone who belongs to a country club, William and Harry can have your shoes private labeled to fit your specific needs. The same applies to your company or any organization you might be affiliated with. This makes you a clear winner. Why? Well, you have a better quality shoe that feels great, and you have the logo of your club, company, or organization on your shoes that really makes you stand out on the golf course. To learn more, visit williamandharry.com today and be sure to input our promotional code 10OFF, M-O-G. That's the number 10, O-F-F, M-O-G, for a 10% discount at williamandharry.com.
Titleist is the number one ball in golf. Yes, being number one is a number, and more players trust the Pro V1 or Pro V1X than all other golf balls combined. But being number one is more than a number. It's a mindset. It's a relentless mission to design and manufacture the best performing golf balls in the game, so you can chase whatever your number one is. Titleist, the number one ball in golf.
Celebrating its 30th year, the South Florida PGA Golf Pass offers the ultimate summer golf experience with special access to more than 100 private, semi-private, and public golf facilities. From May 1st through October 31st, Golf Pass members can enjoy special low rates, exclusive member-only outings, special offers, and more. For just $60, you can purchase the South Florida PGA Golf Pass and instantly gain access to all these great benefits through the member-only app. It's simple. Pay, download, play. Visit sfpgagolf.com/golfpass for more information. That's sfpgagolf.com/golfpass. Joined by the pride of Toronto, Ontario, Lorne Rubenstein, for a special roundtable recap of the 152nd Open here on Musings on Golf, along with the Nostradamus of golf, Bob Bupka, correctly picking Xander Schauffele to win. Hey, Bob, so this marks the first time that since 1982 that the winners of all four of the majors in the same year are Americans. You take that back to last year, it's seven straight major wins for U.S. players. Does that mean anything in particular, Bob, to you?
Well, it's quite an accomplishment. I mean, you know, it's very difficult to do. And, you know, Scottie Scheffler, he won the Masters. And then we know that Xander won the PGA. DeChambeau won the U.S. Open. And now Xander winning the Open Championship. It's pretty hard to dominate in the world of professional golf now. And for four Americans to win all four, I mean, probably, I don't know if Lauren will even agree with me, maybe the odds in Vegas would be greater that no American wins a major championship in a given season rather than Americans winning all four of the majors.
Yeah, well, golf is cyclical, I think you'll agree, Bob. And we have these periods where just sort of one thing keeps happening and happening and happening. I do think, you know, there is perhaps one, foundational reason you could look at why the Americans have been excelling, particularly in the Open Championship. And that is, I think more and more players are welcoming the challenges of links golf. They're going over there, they're playing the Scottish before, they're going over early to get used to the time changes, and they're not complaining so much about conditions. I mean, this time we found it was Shane Lowry complaining a bit too much about conditions and you know, sort of the way the course was set up with extremely long par threes. But the Americans seem to develop the talent to go over there and say, hey, this is the way it's going to be. And of links golf there. And it was interesting to me that after the tournament was over, instead of getting right on the plane and flying back to the States, some of them, Justin Thomas and Jordan Spieth in particular, went with their good buddy Smiley Kaufman. They went to the European Club outside of Dublin, which is a fantastic links course that Pat Ruddy designed, and they played golf there. Most times players would come right home. I don't think they're playing in this week's tournament, the 3M, but they went, they just wanted to keep playing links golf. So I think they're starting to enjoy it more and welcome it more. And I think that might have something to do with the success there. As for the other majors, which are more typical majors, obviously, they all know Augusta and they all know they knew Pinehurst, and it's a more typical type of golf course. They're just, you know, they're the greatest players in the world, and this is what they're doing right now. But the reason they're winning seven in a row is because of the two Opens that they've won in the last while.
Hey, Lauren, help me out by urging, you know, there's so many golf fans that listen to Musings on Golf, and we're highly appreciative. But there's a good percentage of those that have never played a round on a links golf course. Help me strongly urge anybody that has that opportunity. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, you will fall in love with it. And it's so amazing that you hope for bad weather. Now, when do you ever play golf and hope that it's going to be rainy and windy? But if you're going to play links, that's exactly what you would want. Once you do it, you're certainly going to be addicted to it.
Yeah, golf is about so much more than just putting the ball in the air and having it stop on the green exactly where you hit it. It's about so much more than driving the ball 320 yards. It really is about accepting the challenges. Nothing brings that out more than where the game began in the British Isles, and particularly, you know, as we know it in Scotland and the history of the game. I was over there last month up in Dornoch, played a couple of other courses as well, and I was there for 12 days and happened to catch a cold spell. It only warmed up on the last day into the mid-50s. And I was in four layers every day and a toque. And I still loved the golf. I carried my six to eight clubs. I walked the 7 days just playing there. You can walk those links courses because they're mostly flat. The ground is firm. And, you know, as I've gotten older, Bob, you know, I tend to judge courses quite a bit, but can I still walk them? Can I still carry my clubs? And there are a lot of courses here you can. The other thing is that, of course, you don't have too many forced carries. You got to plot your way around, as you said, strategic golf, chess. There's so much that it has to offer. I loved it ever since I went there, really 50 years ago, and I go back as often as I can. I've fallen in love with so much of the golf there, even the courses that nobody has heard of. And I'm always, you know, I can't believe, as you said, that some people just don't go over there because they just want to play in Palm Springs or Florida, warm weather. That's a part of golf, but that is not golf. There's so much more to it. That is not the only. Go over there, accept the challenge. You'll play in conditions, maybe. You may get beautiful conditions, 70 degrees, but you may get the kind of conditions they got on Saturday. And then you'll talk about it, as they say, to your grandchildren later on. You wouldn't believe the day of golf I played in Scotland. And you relish it, something you would never do over here. So, yeah, all of your listeners, get over there. You will want to go back, and you won't regret a minute of it.
So well said, Lauren. I can't thank you enough, and you're echoing my sentiments absolutely to a T.
Yeah, I haven't seen such a big smile come across Mr. Bupka's face in a long time based on those remarks, Lauren. So well done. Hey, Lauren, early on in this conversation, we talked, Bob asked you, we talked about Rory going forward. Tiger Woods, not even really in the ballpark after two rounds at Troon, and really hasn't been a factor for several years on tour, doesn't play very much. He'll be 49 in late December. What do you see going forward for Tiger Woods? Where is he? What do you anticipate?
Well, first of all, I'll say to people who think Tiger shouldn't play anymore because he hasn't been competitive for quite a while with all these injuries and setbacks and so on, I think it's fairly obvious that Tiger has earned the right to play as long as he wants to in these major championships, you know, no matter what he's doing. I'll tell you one thing I learned from doing the book with him, his memoir of the 97 Masters, was how much he just loves the challenge of the game. Whatever is happening to him, he will try to overcome the obstacles, hit different shots. Because of his leg injuries and his back problems, he's had to kind of develop a different kind of a golf swing. I'd love to talk to him really about what compensations he's had to make in his swing, and he's still doing it out there, and he just loves the challenge. So I think as long as he can walk these championship golf courses, he'll keep playing. So you know, I would never argue that he should quit. Yeah, it's a little bit sad to see him going out there and shooting 78s and 76s and missing cuts and so on, but we're still riveted to the screen when he's playing. He still draws in the fans, and you know, what tournament in the world wouldn't want him to be out there playing. And I think let him play as long as he wants. And when he starts feeling deep down, not so much that he can't win, although that's important, that he can't hit the shots with the kind of quality he wants to hit. I mean, he gets a great charge out of being able to hit an excellent golf shot, whether it's along the ground or in the air or whatever. And I think he'll keep playing, really, until that feeling fades. As for Rory, a friend of mine is writing a book, a biography of Rory, and he's spent a lot of time in Northern Ireland talking to people. I think it's going to be a tremendous book because he's talking about, you know, Rory's background a lot as well, following him closely. I think that Rory is just a very interesting character. And as I said, I think at the beginning, I think he will. He's still only, 34, 35 years old. Tom Kite used to say that you don't mature in golf until you're 35. Now, that's not true anymore. Players are coming out. Ludvig Åberg, we see how good they are so young. But I think there's still some truth to the fact that some players maybe don't reach their best until that age. And, you know, Rory reached a crescendo 10 years ago, hasn't won a major since then, but he's still only 35. We shouldn't forget that.
Now, Bob, I completely agree with Lauren in regards to Tiger and his wanting to play and deserving to play. What are your thoughts? You've known him for a long time. Your friends, what do you anticipate going forward with Tiger Woods?
I really agree with Lauren, and I've been saying it for the last couple of weeks. I mean, Tiger Woods, if he wants to tee it up, he has that right to tee it up. If he gets to the point where he thinks he can't even possibly compete, I trust Tiger's judgment. He'll call it a day, and certainly golf fans everywhere for years and years have been the benefactor of the outstanding play of Tiger Woods.
Guys, final question from me regarding the major championships of 2024. Which one did you think was the best, the most riveting, and why? Bob, I'll start with you.
I have to go with Royal Troon. I mean, that compelling performance by Xander Schauffele on Sunday was incredible. The golf course, as an open venue, delivered everything that it could possibly deliver. It was long, it was short, it was rough, it was easy, it was spectacular.
Lauren?
Yeah, it definitely had everything. I would agree with Bob as far as the Open at Troon. I would say the U.S. Open was a very close second down the stretch there, with Rory looking like he was going to win, then making some mistakes, and that bunker shot DeChambeau hit on the last hole was really impressive, fantastic 40-yard bunker shot. You know, they say often that's the toughest shot in golf, and he hit it up there a couple feet from the hole. So that was very compelling as well, on a wonderful course, Pinehurst number 2, that Crenshaw Coore had done so much with over the years. So, yeah, Troon won, and the U.S. Open, too.
Guys, it pains me to my core to have to segue to our next topic, and that is the sudden passing of Mark Carnevale yesterday. As we record this on Tuesday, July 23rd, Mark, who won the 1992 Chattanooga Classic on the PGA Tour, had been with SiriusXM PGA Tour's radio coverage as one of their on-course lead reporters since 2005. Died of a heart attack playing pickleball yesterday in Florida. Just a quick story on this end, Bob. I know you have you and Janice really strong relationship with him. A good buddy of mine, Clay Fitzgerald, who is the president of Congressional Country Club, had called me a month or so ago and invited me to be in a fireside chat in November with the men's group at Congressional in November. Along with Mark. Clay played collegiate golf with Mark at James Madison University. They had remained friends throughout the years, and to the point that even yesterday, on Sunday evening, Clay had talked to Mark, and then less than 12 hours or a day later, he was gone. Bob, I know you and Janice go a long way back with Mark, and this one is really painful.
Yeah, very painful. I was in total shock when I got the news, and I automatically start thinking back of Mark and how much great time we spent, not only at the events, but afterwards at dinners and just hanging around, having a chat. And the one thing that Mark was the proudest of was that his dad was the head basketball coach at Navy, and Mark was so proud of that, and he knew that I had a pretty extensive basketball background, so we chatted about that. Mark, let me just say one thing. You were a good broadcaster, you were a good friend, and you are going to be missed.
You and Mark, Bob, were the first two on-course reporters for PGA Tour Radio, I believe, and Janice was the first on-course producer back in 2005, so you go a long way back with him. A funny guy, witty guy, right? And boy, I'll tell you, listening to him on PGA Tour Radio, he knew his stuff, and when they threw it to Carney to tell the listeners what was going on, he knew exactly what was happening.
Oh, he was on top of his game, whether he was playing in 1992, Rookie of the Year on the PGA Tour, and we constantly bragged about that. Mark Carnevale, you laid your mark. You're a great guy, an even better friend.
Lorne, talk a little bit about your career, please. You mentioned about your desire to be a writer. A Canadian kid, the season is limited. I lived in the Detroit area for about 7 years, so I understand about a compressed period of time. When did you start to play golf, and when did you start to want to write about golf?
Well, I started to play golf really not until I was about 11, 12, 13. My dad was a pretty good athlete. As a matter of fact, he played some professional football for the Winnipeg Blue Bombers for a short time till he got injured. And, you know, he was a very good athlete, and he introduced me to the game. He called himself a screwed-up left-hander, but that was okay. He enjoyed the game, and I remember watching the 1966 U.S. Open on television, and I was downstairs, and my dad called me up and said, "Come on up. There's a guy around your age who's doing pretty well." It was Johnny Miller, and I watched the rest of the tournament, and of course Miller went ahead and won that tournament. So, you know, that was just I think it was Casper who won the tournament over Palmer, but Miller was doing really well as an 18-year-old, finished eighth or something. So I became very aware of championship golf, started to play competitive amateur golf. I played some, you know, decent tournaments for a long time. I caddied on the PGA Tour while I was in graduate school. I got to know one player very, very well, Bob Dixon, who won the U.S. and British Amateurs. He was the first guy I caddied for, and we're still friends. He ended up running, you know, what was the Hogan Tour, now the Corn Ferry Tour. He lives up in Jacksonville, Pontevedra. And then I got to know Jim Nelford. I went over and played in the 77 British Amateur, and I met Jim, who had won the 75 and 76 Canadian Amateurs. He'd won the Western Amateur while he was at Brigham Young. And when it came back, when he turned pro, I started caddying for him, and I think he would have gone on to have a hell of a career, except, of course, he had that almost career-ending water skiing accident in 1985. But so I got into the game, and one thing led to another, and approached our national paper with an idea for a golf column, and they went for it, and that lasted 33 years. Even though I was a freelancer, I felt like I worked for them, and they felt I worked for them. So really, it's been a very fortunate career, and I think deep down, I felt that there was a lot to the game from many, many elements, and there was so much to write about in golf, and I was very fortunate that magazines, and in my case, the newspaper here in Canada, wanted to write about all aspects of the game. And you guys remember back then, Golf World, Golf Journal, even, you know, non-golf magazines, Travel and Leisure Golf, they took Toronto Life magazine. I wrote some articles for them on golf, one on the golfing machine. I remember going out to a class. So I could go on and on about this, and maybe I am, but golf is just a wonderful game to write about, and I was lucky to do it for so many years.
Well, and I would imagine looking ahead, you have the President's Cup coming up not before too long at Royal Montreal. That's got to be a source of great pride for the country. Mike Weir is your captain. I would imagine that Lorne Rubenstein will be among those covering that very special event.
Well, I was there in 2007, which was fantastic. And I ended up writing a book about it for the club, for Royal Montreal. And I remember the last day when Weir went up against Tiger Woods, everybody was hoping that would be the case. And the two captains put them against each other. Clearly, the American team was going to win handily. It was all over after Saturday. But nobody cared about that up in Montreal. If there were 35,000 people there, 34,800 were watching Tiger and Mike, not the other man. matches. So it was a really exciting event. It was a perfect day. It was late. It was in, you know, later in the season than fall here. And we're hoping we get the same weather this year. And it should be a compelling event with at least a couple of Canadians on it. I mean, they're close to automatically qualifying. But if not, I'm sure Weir will pick at least a couple, you know, Nick Taylor, Corey Connors, Mackenzie Hughes, who knows, there's a bunch of them really right there.
That's a really growing contingent of Canadian players who are playing really well on tour. Lorne Rubenstein, outstanding writer. Final question from me. It's one we like to ask all of our guests, and that would be, who would round out a dream foursome for you? Who would be the three people, whether they're living or deceased, who you'd like to play a magical round of golf with, and where would you play that round of golf?
Well, if I go first here, I would have to say, because of my fascination with the golf swing, which has probably harmed my own game over the years, but, you know, it's been a lot of fun writing about the golf swing and changes and how they teach it. I'd have to pick three golfers who really, you know, I would say represent the acme of the apex of the game in terms of their golf swings. I would say Ben Hogan, obviously, Mickey Wright, who, you know, I've always been fascinated by, and I wish there was a book on Mickey besides the one she did, Play Golf the Right Way. What a golf swinger she was, as you guys know. I mean, she won everything on the LPGA Tour, all kinds of majors, you know, left the game fairly early, retired fairly early, but still loved hitting golf balls out of her back porch at home in Florida. And the third one, no surprise, would be Bobby Jones. I mean, I would love to have been around him. He could write. He was a wonderful writer, had a great, you know, understanding of the game. I think he was a very well-rounded guy. So those three, Mickey Wright, Ben Hogan, and Bobby Jones. And I would have to take them to Royal Dornoch, I'm afraid. I'm not afraid. I'd love to take them to Royal Dornoch.
Yeah, thank you. Hey, Mr. Bubka, as I look at you, you know, I've asked this question of a lot of people, but I don't think I've ever asked you. Bubka, who would you play, though? Who would round out your dream foursome, and where would you play?
I've listened to you ask that question, and I never really thought of an answer. But obviously, Jack Nicklaus, who's been a good friend, and when I say good friend, when you get a letter on your birthday wishing you a happy birthday from Jack Nicklaus, he's a pretty good friend. Arnold Palmer would be, and probably Lee Trevino, just to spice things up. So that'd be a pretty good foursome. I think if we played anywhere but Augusta National, I probably would be shot.
Lorne Rubenstein, this has been a real treat. Bob, I know you, as you said early on, you and Lorne go way, way back. Been a lot of fun with your old friend, hasn't it?
It certainly has, and I admired his work from time afar, and still admire his work to this day.
Well, thank you, guys. It's been I was so glad and honored that you invited me to be on this podcast, and I enjoyed every minute of it. Thank you.
Lorne, thank you so much. Terry Foltz, longtime golf channel commentator, who a couple of years ago went over to Live Golf to be one of their commentators, will be our special guest next week. We look forward to having Jerry on. Lorne Rubenstein, it's been a real treat. We wish you well, and I know you'll be rooting for the international team come this fall when the President's Cup returns to Royal Montreal. Lorne, thanks again so very much.
Thanks, Lorne.
You bet.